Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org. Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. I'm your host, John DeLynn. And as always, I'm very excited to have with me a very special guest. Today, my guest is a man by the name of Brant Gardner. Hi, Brant.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Now, Brant is interesting in from my perspective for a couple reasons. Many of you will know that I've interviewed Grant Palmer on this podcast about his book, An Insider's View of Mormon Origins, where he talks about his theories on the origins of the Book of Mormon. I've also interviewed Richard Bushman, who's talked a lot about kind of his views of the Book of Mormon, and I've interviewed Terrell Givens. When I originally planned to interview Grant Palmer, I worked really hard with Fair and Farms to try and get someone who I believed would be sort of credible, kind of a scholar or a really thoughtful person to respond to the Grant Palmer interview. I asked lots of people and no one was willing to do the interview. Brant Gardner, as far as I can tell, is one of the better people that I could ever hope for to respond to the critics' attacks on the Book of Mormon. He also has a lot to say about archaeology and I think would be one of the better people that I could find as well to speak to the Michael Coe interview where we talked about Book of Mormon archaeology and his, you know, Dr. Coe's outsider's view. Those are all podcasts that I strongly recommend you guys listen to. But let me just go ahead, Brant, and read your bio, if that's okay.
Yes.
From your book, it says, Brant Gardner earned his M.S. in anthropology, specializing in Mesoamerican ethnohistory from the State University of New York at Albany. You are the author of a 6-volume series published by Coford Books called Second Witness Analytical and Contextual Commentary on the Book of Mormon. You are also the author of the main book that we're going to be featuring today called The Gift and Power, Translating the Book of Mormon by Brant A. Gardner, again brought to you by Greg Coford Books. And you've presented lots of papers for Fair, Farms, Sunstone. You've written articles for Meridian Magazine. And you and your wife, Valerie, have 4 children and 11 grandchildren. Is there anything I've left out of that bio?
I think that covers it.
Okay. And also, I want to note this. This maybe is going to seem a little bit self-serving, but it's not really. I've become relatively good friends with a man by the name of Greg Coford. Some of you may know who he is, but my guess is that most of you don't. Greg Coford is a publisher. He publishes books, and he publishes good books, really high-quality books, and he's a thoughtful, I'm going to say, sophisticated Mormon in his own right, and his books deserve attention. And so I had some talks with Greg, and we sort of made this deal that I would help promote some of his better books, and he would offer our listeners a discount. And then finally, for every book that's bought, using the code that I'm about to give you, maybe a small amount of that is going to come to Mormon Stories to help us fund the podcast, etc. So the website is gregcoford.com. That's gregcofford.com. And the promotion code is MSTORIES, all in caps, MSTORIES, all in caps. So I want to encourage you guys, if you like what we talk about today with Brant Gardner, to go up onto Greg Coford Books and to type in that code and to buy this book, The Gift and Power, Translating the Book of Mormon, and any other books that Greg offers. And we're just going to see if we can help drive some sales to Greg because his books are good, and also see to what extent, we can help out Mormon Stories with projects like this. So that's my, that's my disclaimer and all the news items. And now I'm ready to jump into the book. Is that all right?
Fine here.
Okay. So first and foremost, Brant, let's talk a little bit about your history. That's something we always do with Mormon Stories. And we don't have to go into lots of detail, but just tell us a bit about your upbringing in the church and what are the things that kind of led you to want to study Mesoamerican, you know, archaeology, and what led you to the route of writing scholarly books about Mormonism.
I grew up in the church, so I don't have any great conversion story to tell. What I have is sort of the process that I went through. I was always interested in things like archaeology. I had somebody give me a book when I was somewhere around 12 that covered archaeology of the world in a mode that was appropriate for 12-year-olds, and I was absolutely fascinated with it. Went on my mission to Spain.
Were you raised in Utah?
I spent a little bit of time in Utah. I was raised in probably California more often than Utah.
And born in the church?
Born in the church.
Pioneer ancestry, all that?
Yeah, actually, if you've got any listeners that are in the Utah area and they've heard of Gardner Mill in West Jordan, how many greats grandfather of mine that founded that, and my father remembers working in it when it was a working flour mill, and now it's a restaurant. So
nice. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So raised mostly in California.
Right.
Served a mission where?
Served a mission in Spain.
Oh, okay.
And it turned out that sort of had one of the two major influences in the direction that I was interested in going. Because obviously, if you're going to serve in Spain, one of the languages that you're going to learn is going to be Spanish. So I remember being on my mission and teaching all of these things about the great white God and how that related to the Book of Mormon. And when I got back from my mission, I was going to BYU and decided that what I really needed to do was to read up on this great white God, because now that I spoke the language, I could actually read the sources. And then when somebody said, "Is that really true?" I could say, "Well, yes, of course it is, because I read it and now I know that it's true."
Right.
And then I went to BYU and got into the library and started doing the research and found out that the sources didn't say what everybody said that they were saying.
Right.
And, you know, the very short version of that very long story is that I really don't see any connection between the great white God Quetzalcoatl and Jesus Christ at all. Those are all of the things that make it appear that there is something connected. Are all related to much later Spanish interpretations of native myth rather than anything that the Indians believed or talked about.
Right.
But that also got me to the point where I said, wow, this is absolutely fascinating stuff. And although it doesn't relate directly to the Book of Mormon, I am now in love with it. And so that fostered my desire to learn more about Mesoamerica and traipsed off to Albany, New York, to do graduate work.
Okay, real quick, was that at all disconcerting to you? That, I mean, I remember those film strips that I used to show, you know, as a missionary. I think it was called Ancient America Speaks, but I don't remember. But we'd show these.
Oh yeah,
these film strips, and you know, we would tell Native Americans or Latin Americans that they were descendants of Laman and Lemuel, and we would talk about the Popol Vuh in Guatemala, and we would show, you know, we would basically say that Jesus was the great white God that was in the Popol Vuh, just because that's kind of that's the material the church was putting out.
And went back to John Taylor, who said that, you know, from all of the evidence he could see, it looked like Quetzalcoatl was a remembrance of Jesus Christ. And the key idea there isn't that John Taylor was by revelation saying this. He said, from all the evidence I see. Well, what evidence was he reading? And again, it was the evidence that made it look similar. But a lot of what we are able to know about that kind of mythology simply wasn't available at the time. Now, was it disconcerting to me? Not really. Specifically about that video, Ancient American Speak, America Speaks, while I was at BYU, I got to know some of the BYU professors, archaeologists, and the people who were doing work. And I was sitting around talking to them one day, and that film strip came up. And one of them said, oh, yeah, we usually put that on for a good laugh. We consider it a comedy.
So how can that not... I mean, maybe you were just more sophisticated than me, but how can that not cause you to, you know, some concern, at least from the standpoint that, you know, the church is putting out this curriculum that it's giving to missionaries that's saying stuff that you find to not be, you know, maybe accurate or relevant. How do you avoid, I'm not saying that that should destroy your testimony, but how do you avoid not having some cognitive dissonance about it, or concern, or a feeling like we can't be misleading people? How do you avoid not feeling those things?
I guess a part of it is to understand what the nature of revelation is, and you know, the sort of the human side of inspiration. I can believe that prophets are inspired. I really have a hard time believing that they're inspired in what they choose for breakfast. It is entirely possible that you can have a church that's led by God and have real human beings that are involved in it doing the best they can with the best information that they have. And so they come up with some of these things, and they're popular for a time because it's the best information they have. And then typically when they learn that there is something better going on, then they kind of move those things away and, you know, learn something else. And that's what happened, of course, with Ancient America Speaks. We don't show that anymore. And it's been replaced with things that have a much better scholarly foundation.
So, okay, so, you know, what you just articulated, I think, is a, I don't want to sound condescending, but that sounds like a more mature, informed view on Mormonism and spirituality. But it's not necessarily a point of view that is encouraged by CES. It's not the type of point of view that you would come out of 4 years of seminary or 4 years of institute or BYU and just sort of have naturally. People who usually have that perspective have to kind of earn it and fight for it, and many people get lost along the way. Were you raised with that perspective? Did it just come to you through reading? How'd you arrive there?
I suppose it was just reading. I certainly wasn't raised with that kind of understanding. I was raised in the same church that pretty much everybody else was. And, you know, when I was younger, I would smile when they talked about people coming across the Bering Strait, because of course I knew better, and everybody came across with Lehi. It was a process of simply learning more and understanding, and probably just continuing to learn. I find that the more I read and the more I understand, you know, the less I have those problems of cognitive dissonance.
But you had this perspective as a college student at BYU.
Certainly by the time I got back from my mission, I did. Exactly what it might have been like before that, I'm not sure.
Okay. All right, well, good. So, all right, so you decide to go off to grad school to study this stuff more in depth, is that right?
I did, and at that particular point in time, pretty much gave up the idea of studying it with any relationship to the Book of Mormon. I really wanted to do Mesoamerican research because I was in love with the field and fascinated with it. And my particular specialty was sort of Central America or Central Mexican religion. And all of that comes much, much later than the Book of Mormon. So the things that I was really terribly interested in at the time had to do with the fact that when I was going through graduate school in the early 70s, that's where we had the texts. That's where we had the largest amount of material where you could learn something. The decipherment of the Maya hieroglyphs has altered that perspective within the last, you know, 40 years. But in the early 70s, if you wanted to know something about Mesoamerican religion, you were required to go to Central Mexico because that's where we had the information. So that's what I was interested in. There is a smaller piece of that story, however, which is while I was at Brigham Young University, I did meet John Sorensen. And in one of my conversations with him, I told him that I had kind of come to the conclusion that I just wasn't going to find a real-world location for the Book of Mormon. And I was pretty convinced that I'd have to take it on faith and wasn't ever going to really see anything that would convince me that it had really taken place in any location that I was going to be able to find and know anything about. And at that point in time, this was prior to the publication of his book, An Ancient American Setting of the Book of Mormon, and he gave me a manuscript to go through.
What year would this have been about?
This would have been, let's say, 72, 73.
Okay.
Somewhere in there, and the book was published in 85.
Okay.
So I had the manuscript prior to that time.
Okay, so Sorensen was doing research to try and establish some type of, Central American setting for the Book of Mormon?
He'd been working on it for a number of years. I'm sure that probably by at least 1950, the outlines of the geography that he favored were probably reasonably well set, and it was a question of sort of defining it and refining it between like 1950 and the 1970s.
Okay.
And then maybe a little bit more by the time of the publication of his book. But as I remember it, there weren't huge differences between the manuscript and the actual published text.
And what were your thoughts about the manuscript at the time you read it?
I was thoroughly excited. I said, doggone it, the guy's done it. He's giving me a way of seeing the Book of Mormon where I could relate it to real people. And part of the reason that that could happen is because I understood that area of the world. And one of the major things that it allowed me to do was to reconceptualize the Book of Mormon so that I was no longer in my mind picturing a Book of Mormon that happened in Jerusalem with everybody wearing clothes from the Middle East and everybody acting like what we understand the world of the ancient Near East to have been. But I could see it occurring with the people that I understood, a very different culture, a very different background. And it made all the difference in the way I read the Book of Mormon.
Okay. And so you still see, do you still view his theories as plausible or viable in terms of geography and the Book of Mormon?
Yes, and then I should probably qualify that because he and I probably disagree on several things, even though there's probably a major amount of agreement.
Okay.
I've been through, for instance, every geographical theory that I can think of, and his is the only one I've been able to find that actually makes sense in the real world. So from that standpoint, his basic geography backing away perhaps on some of the identifications of specific cities. But that general relationship seems to work, seems to describe, locations and interconnectedness in ways that I've not seen anywhere else. And then what I did when I was going through the commentary on the Book of Mormon was to say, if I take that location and read the Book of Mormon against it, does that tell us something about the Book of Mormon that we would not otherwise learn? The result of that process is I am quite convinced that the Book of Mormon took place in that area, and I have a very hard time reading it without seeing it in that cultural context.
Again, in which area?
In the area that John Sorensen has located would have the land of Nephi, probably in Highland Guatemala.
Okay.
And then in the Grijalva River Valley would be where Zarahemla had been located. And then Jaredite lands probably up along the Gulf Coast to the north.
Okay. And we'll get into the different theories in a bit. But
sure.
I guess in your timeline, it's just good to know you were in some ways contemporaries with John Sorensen, were familiar with his work, and what, that informed your graduate studies?
It informed my sort of religious understanding
as
I was going through the graduate studies. So in my graduate studies, I was not doing anything overtly related to the Book of Mormon. Most of what I was trying to do is nail down that Quetzalcoatl character and try to figure out what was going on.
Oh, okay.
But that by then had nothing to do with the Book of Mormon.
Got it. Okay. So so take us from getting your master's degree to now, just in terms of what track you followed in terms of, you know, Book of Mormon scholarship.
For a long time, probably relatively dormant in that I had to actually go work for a living. My wife became addicted to having food on the table and a roof over her head. And so we had to feed that particular need. So it was, 20 years plus, I guess, that I really didn't do much except read, both in Mesoamerican archaeology and sort of thinking a little bit in the Book of Mormon. The real change occurred after we had moved to Albuquerque and I got online. And, you know, by that time, this is 15, 16 years ago. By that time, the internet was a little bit easier to manipulate than it had been earlier. And there was a list that discussed LDS doctrine and scripture. And the guy who ran the list contacted me and said, you know, I'd really like you to do sort of a magazine article once a week. And I knew that one of the biggest problems I would possibly have with that is coming up with a topic every week. So I said, well, here's what we'll do. We'll do a nice, slow commentary on the Book of Mormon. And I can do that once a week. And we'll just go and see what happens. And then I became addicted to that process. And that turned into the 6-volume commentary that Covert has published. And so that's kind of what got me back into thinking about, you know, the Book of Mormon and Mesoamerica and writing on those topics.
So you did that 6-volume series before you did The Gift and Power?
That's correct.
Okay. When did you publish those?
The first one came out, I think it was December of 2007.
Okay.
And then the rest of them early in 2008. That was the last time we, as a church, were doing the Book of Mormon. So we were trying really hard to get it out so that, as Greg Cofert has said, the wonderful LDS buying market doesn't buy those kinds of things except when gospel doctrine comes around.
Right.
So.
So you try to get them ready. Okay. Well, that makes good sense. And so, anything else about your background or history before we dive into your views on Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon?
No, I think that probably covers it. I'm not even sure that was interesting, but everything else is even less.
Okay. All right. Well, let's start with Joseph Smith. And your book, The Gift and Power, Translating the Book of Mormon, goes into all this stuff in reasonable depth. And so what I'm going to do is present the typical, let's just say, non-faithful view of Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon. And then I want just to have you talk about your perspective so that those who desire to believe in the Book of Mormon and Joseph Smith or who are struggling can maybe hear, I don't want to put you up as a role model, but maybe just alternative approaches to ones that would necessarily preclude faith. Does that make sense?
Sure. Okay. It does.
Okay. So, you know, most people, when they start studying church history, realize that Joseph Smith, that there was an environment of folk magic, you know, divining for water, treasure seeking, treasure digging, you know, in the New York area and probably in other states in the early 1800s, that Joseph Smith and his father and many of his friends and associates all participated in. And so, there would be rumors of gold mines, Spanish gold mines, or, you know, buried treasure. And Joseph would either take part in or lead expeditions to help people try and find this buried treasure. And he would often do it using some type of stone that could be called a seer stone or a peep stone or something else to search for that buried treasure. Now, tell me if I've got that right and if you would add anything to that narrative?
I guess what I'd add to the narrative is that we know the basic outlines that are there, and the question is, what is really going on with all of that? Because as soon as we hear that Joseph Smith was involved with even divining rods, we're kind of wondering what was going on. But there's enough of a tradition of, you know, the witching stick or the divining rod, that one doesn't sound terribly strange. But when you get into a seer stone that were sometimes more derogatively called a peep stone, boy, that just sounds strange. And so what I was hoping to do in about the first third of the book is try to understand, you know, what was going on, what was that culture like, you know, why would Joseph Smith get involved in doing some of these things? And then part of it is also trying to understand why we tell the stories that we do, because one of the very important pieces of information is that as the historians learn more about that part of Joseph's life, we understand that he translated the Book of Mormon using a seer stone. But there have been a lot of stories since then that even Joseph Fielding Smith, who said, no, he would never have used the seer stone. A couple of other people denied that would have ever happened. Certainly when artists depict the translation of the Book of Mormon, that's not typically the way LDS artists will depict it. And so there is a question of, you know, if we know something about the history, how is it that we get these other questions? And so the history of the history is probably, you know, another one of those things that's kind of interesting. But if we go back to Joseph Smith and we try to understand what he was doing, one of the really important things is to understand that the world that Joseph Smith lived in is a different kind of world than the one we lived in. And things that we call magic would not have had that label at the time. They would simply be, this is the way people do things. When I was looking at that history, I looked at the history of those kinds of practices in England. And, you know, prior to the time that people would have police forces, one of the ways that they would try to find out, you know, who the thief was or where something was lost, they'd go to somebody who used a stone to find things. And it was part of the tradition coming out of England that if you had something that was lost, you would go to this person who would consult their seer stone, and they would tell you where the thing was that was hidden, or they would say, this is the person who stole it. So it was a very long history of these things that continued in the New World and in America. And what was interesting is it's about that time that there begins to be a kind of a dichotomy between the people who would believe those things and a more educated populace that was moving off of the Eastern Seaboard and populating more and more of the territory that once had been a frontier, but now was even less so. And so you get places like Palmyra that had a distinct population of people who had some of these older, more rural beliefs, and then the newer people coming in that were more highly educated. And in addition to the question of seer stones, you have a population where some people believe and other people say, oh, that's just terrible. And it's that sort of division in perspective that explains a lot of the stories that we hear about Joseph Smith and what he was doing with the seer stone. One of those things, for instance, everybody knows, or I guess everybody knows is the wrong way to put it, but most of us have heard that there was something about Joseph Smith and using a seer stone for treasure hunting. And all of that just seems terribly weird. And one of the things you mentioned is that maybe Joseph Smith had led some of these things. As you look at what Joseph Smith was doing, the majority of people, and it wasn't just Joseph Smith, there were other people in the area that used seer stones. There were other people in other states who used seer stones. The whole idea of the seer stone in popular usage was that it's something that would help you find something that was lost or not easily visible. So people who were looking for buried treasure would go to someone who was a user of a seer stone and request their help, hoping that this person could help them find something. And that's kind of what we find with Joseph Smith. At least in every case that we know of, Joseph never solicited business with the seer stone. People always came to him and said, I want your services, and basically hired him to do what it was that he did. So that whole world about how you use them and what you use them for was very, very different from what we expect, and certainly not in the definitions of magic, and certainly not occult magic like we tend to think.
Okay. What power do you think people assumed was driving the stones or those who were finding things?
You know, I'm not sure that they would have known much about power. I think all of those, you know, what power is it that makes it happen, are modern definitions where we're trying to say, you know, it's either God or the devil doing it. I don't think those are definitions that those people would have understood. Pardon me. If they would have thought about it, it certainly would have been, you know, some good divine angelic power that was helping them out, but in a very generalized way. This was very much simply a talent that someone had, and there would be someone in the village who was talented with herbs and healing. There was somebody else, you know, who was talented with the seer stone, somebody else with finding water with the witching stick. And these communities that had to rely on themselves would have these local specialists. And in most cases, they were considered to be people who had a good power. Now, where it came from, I'm not sure any of them ever wondered or cared, as long as it worked.
Got it. Okay. So it seems like you're saying that this was certainly something that wasn't uncommon, that happened, you know, in Europe and in America. Maybe it happened mostly among, maybe the less educated you got, the more common this would be, but there were certainly still educated, affluent people who engaged in these types of behaviors. Is that all a fair summary of what you're saying?
Yes, all of that's true. There was certainly a continuum, and there would be educated people who would still believe, just like, and you get it even less now, but certainly, you know, when I was growing up in the early 50s, you'd find well-educated people that, you know, would not walk under a ladder or would worry about a black cat crossing their path.
Okay. And so you're also sort of saying that it wasn't necessarily some dark art, occult kind of thing, or maybe not at all.
Not at all. Nobody who was involved in it would have thought that it was a dark art at all.
Okay. What about those who would say, well, if Joseph had his first vision at age 14 or 13 or 12, whenever, whenever he had it, that he would have had better sense than to engage in this kind of stuff because, you know, he would have the access of God. He would have been inspired and, you know, been serious about preparing to form the church, and he just wouldn't have engaged in such silliness or nonsense.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting way of doing history. You've got multiple options of how to understand history, and unfortunately, one of the ones that we usually take is, well, if I were to do it, this is how I would have done it. Or the other correlation, if I were God, this is what I would have had happen. None of those things explain history, because they presume that people in history, or, you know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, must have been in a world just like ours and thought exactly the way that we do, and therefore we have to come up with some excuse as to why they didn't act the way we think they should have. And that's the wrong approach to take. You don't go back in history and say, why wasn't that person modern? you look at the influences that that person was under and you say, okay, let me understand how they lived, when they lived, how that influenced their development and how they moved from point to point. So, you know, the idea of, you know, if Joseph Smith had really seen God, he must have done something differently begs the question, because it presumes that we can be this omniscient God and decide how things should have happened.
So it says more about the questioner than it does anything else.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Okay, so the answer is we don't know. Like, you know, maybe God was okay with, maybe, you know, God never had an opinion about it. Maybe maybe Joseph was just learning as he went and bumbled along the way. I mean, lots of different theories about,
you know, if Moses is going to get water out of a rock and taps it with his rod, there are some really good reasons why he would use his rod to do that. But most of us today would never think of saying, you know, if I had this big wooden stick, I think I'll go pound on that rock until water comes out. it is a completely different way of looking at things. And the only reason we accept those things in the Bible is because they're old enough that we say, oh, well, way back then, the world must have been different, and this is how God did things. God has always worked with the understanding of the people in the time and the place where they were. And I don't see any reason for God to have changed his method of dealing with humans when he got to Joseph Smith. And I don't see any reason why he has to change because I'm different than Joseph Smith was.
Okay. Well, is it true? Have you ever found any indication that any, you know, it's clear that people went to Joseph to find treasure. Is there any indication that any treasure was ever found?
Oh, not that I know of, no.
So why did people keep coming to him if he wasn't finding anything? And why did he keep entertaining expeditions if he was never finding anything? Isn't that odd a little bit?
Oh, yeah. And the odd part isn't in what happened with Joseph. It's the specific question you asked me, because you said, did they find treasure? Well, I know very, very few people ever found treasure, ever. And, you know, there's one well-documented case where Joseph was hired to help find treasure. And perhaps out of that entire thing, the best treasure he found was his wife when he was, you know, off trying to find this mine. But most of the time people came to him, they weren't looking for treasure. They were looking for something else. Somebody came to Joseph and were looking for a lost horse. And he told him where the horse was, and the guy went out and found the horse. A judge had lost his pocketbook and came to Joseph and said, you know, I've lost it. Can you help me figure out where it was? And Joseph gave him an answer. And oddly enough, we've got about two or three stories, not a lot, but two or three stories that place Joseph in the context of the typical village seer, person who found lost things. And what's really fascinating about the stories that have been preserved is they're all stories where Joseph was successful. There are stories preserved about Sally Chase, who was also one who used a seer stone to find things that were lost. And oddly enough, the stories that are preserved for her don't have her succeeding. I think the reality is, if you look at, you know, anybody in that world, anybody who would have used a seer stone would have successes and then probably some misses. If they didn't have some success, nobody would come back to them twice.
So do you believe that Joseph had a power to, do you personally believe that he had the power to find stuff, hidden stuff? Or do you even have a position?
That one's complicated because as soon as you say, well, yes, he had a power, now we're making him mystical. You know, I think there was something that was going on, and that's part of why I spend time in the third part of the book looking at what you might call scientific reasons to explain how seer stones work. The only thing I can tell you about some of those things is that there are people who have claimed to have some similar capabilities in the modern world and have inexplicable success. There's a story that I read, I believe it was Elizabeth Meyer, who was who ended up writing a book because of the experience that she had. Her daughter had a very expensive, I believe it was a cello, and we're talking, vintage and lots of money here, not hundreds, but thousands, probably tens of thousands of dollars, and somebody had stolen it. Nobody could find it, and so she finally went to someone who wasn't using a seer stone, but was someone who professed to be able to find lost things. He was in a completely different state and was able to tell her exactly where it was and what was happening with it, and she was able to recover it. So she writes her book talking about the fact that this thing is inexplicable and that there are inexplicable things that happen, none of which invoke the divine. They just, something happens. And I think in many cases, that's kind of what was happening with Joseph Smith. There was something there, and exactly what it was, I'm not sure.
Yeah, you'd be speculating. Yeah. What do you think about the Richard Bushman theory, or at least the one that I've attributed to him, that this was Joseph's way of practicing accessing God's power, these behaviors?
That's certainly one of the theories that I've seen people use. Not really the idea that I would have behind it. I think that rather than see Joseph using that to practice, I see God using what Joseph was doing to help him become something else. So there is an idea that Joseph was in training to become the prophet. And I guess I don't subscribe to that one. I think God took a more active hand in it and said, Joseph, you're going to be the prophet. And, if you put yourself in Joseph's position, how in the world is Joseph going to translate the Book of Mormon? He knows it's in a language he can't read. He doesn't understand it. He knows he doesn't have a dictionary. How in the world is he ever going to do this? The only way he's ever known to be able to do something that other people can't is through the seer stone. So God says, use what you know, which I think is what God does with all of us. Is he said, use who you are and become better than what you've been.
Okay. We'll talk more about the Book of Mormon translation in a bit. But what would you say to people who just say, look, Joseph was a con man. He just, and your book talks about this. So I'm quoting one of the chapters of your book in terms of the use of that word, right?
Right.
What would you say about the fact that instead of him receiving the first vision, being righteous, receiving the first vision, doing some cultural stuff that then leads to his fulfilling of God's prophecies, instead he started out doing this goofy folk magic stuff, realized that he could convince people that he had power, and then from that said, well, heck, why don't I invent a book and invent a religion? Yeah. Because people clearly will believe that I have power, so I may as well capitalize on that.
Yeah. I mean, he was even brought to court and basically accused of being a con man prior to the time of the Book of Mormon. This is involved with the seer stone and the silver mine. So there were people who certainly thought that he was a con man. The question is, people believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet and people still believe that he is not. It isn't a question of what do we believe, but, what kind of evidence do we have? So we know that people believed he was a con man. The question is, was he? Is there any evidence for it? And if you look at what con men did, particularly those who used things like seer stones, they'd come into a town and they'd promise, find great treasure. All you have to do is buy shares. And then once they collect the money, the guy would skedaddle out of town, take the money and run.
Kind of like the Music Man.
Yeah, exactly like the Music Man. The Music Man is the quintessential con man. And all of the evidence that we have for Joseph Smith is that he didn't do any of that. He lived in the community. He stayed in the community. People would consult him. People came back to him. The only person, you know, the person who actually took him to trial wasn't a member of the community. It was a nephew of Josiah Stoll who had hired Joseph, and, you know, his Josiah Stoll's the one who came and and said, you don't know, Joseph is, you know, upright and upstanding and testified in his behalf, even though they didn't find the silver. The guy who hired him to find it, you know, stood behind him. So there really isn't any indication that there was ever anything in Joseph's character that would have qualified for the definition of con man.
A lot of this is in a later time period, but a lot of people would call the Kirtland Bank stuff, that would come to their mind as something that might approximate this type of fraud or deception for some. Is that fair? Yeah. Is that fair to make that association, or maybe not for you?
That people would look at it that way, certainly. Whether or not that's evidence that you would take of that, no, I don't think so, because you, again, it's a question of understanding history. You know, what the banks were and how they operated was significantly different then than they are now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the historical context, you really can't, again, say that there was any conning going on there. Everybody knew what was happening. Certainly a financial disaster, and certainly not one where you'd want to say there was, you know, a lot of great inspiration in it, seemed to have been a pretty human endeavor and failed very humanly, but not as a means of deception.
Even, you know, I thought I remember reading something about there being gold and then bricks, fake bricks underneath, you know, something that would show deception in terms of the financial backing behind the deposits in the bank. Are you familiar with any of that?
Yeah, I remember that, you know, those were methods they were trying to do to stop a panic. And again, it's a question of, you know, what are they trying to do? And if you're trying to stop a run on the bank, people have tried all kinds of things. You know, if it would have worked, maybe things might have turned out differently. But
you're saying that that's different than setting up a con from the start. In your mind,
right?
They set up a bank and it went bad, and then maybe they tried to cover it up. But that's different from setting up a bank for the purposes of defrauding people.
Exactly, and I'm not even sure that I'd say covering up as much as trying to bolster. You know, trying to salvage whatever it was. You know, it was a failed bank, and it was a failed bank at a time lots of banks failed. So,
okay.
And certainly, you know, in modern history, we've seen banks fail. So, none of that should be surprising to us.
So, in all those instances where Joseph, this is something that really got me. You know, I remember in Sunday school and primary hearing about Joseph, you know, being brought to court, and, you know, the way it was always painted was, you know, Satan inspires wicked people to fight against the Lord's anointed, and so people brought Joseph to court on spurious matters, and there were never any grounds for anything he was brought to court on, and it was all because they were trying to fight God's righteous plan, when in reality, you know, what were these trials and what were these courts about, and from your perspective?
Well, Joseph was involved in so many of them that we probably shouldn't sort of overgeneralize from any particular one. But in many cases, people had, you know, various beefs with Joseph. In the case of the one that we've already talked about, the Bainbridge trial, when he was brought up for being, you know, basically a con man for using a seer stone, the person who brought the suit, I'm sure, sincerely believed that Joseph Smith was a con man. So I suspect that there's a very complicated history. I suspect that they get simplified when you get into Sunday school classes. And then again, the more you understand of history, you know, the more complex things become. And I doubt there were very many satanic people trying to bring him to court. Might have been a few, of course. I doubt that was the major reason.
Okay. But he was brought to court. And was he ever actually prosecuted for any of that behavior or ever found to be a con? to your knowledge?
That depends on how you read the information coming out of the courts.
Was he ever fined or put in jail for any of that behavior? Found guilty?
Not that I'm aware of, no. There were no guilty verdicts rendered. Although some of the history on some of these is muddy enough that there, might have been something where they said, okay, cease and desist, don't use that thing anymore. But not so much that he was convicted of being a disorderly person, which at that time would have been the con man.
Okay. Okay. And if I understand the history right, you get the sense that he was torn about participating in a lot of this stuff. And you even get a sense that at times he swore that he would stop and then started again. Is that right?
I think what happened, at least in the way I read the history, is that Joseph was a village seer who performed these functions of finding things. And then Moroni comes along and says, you got something much more important to do than finding lost horses. You need to translate a lost book. And that process took him 4 years before, from the time when Moroni came and said, this is your mission, to the time that he did it. The trial in Bainbridge came in between those times. I think what happened is in those 4 years, Moroni said, you have to learn how to do something else, with this particular talent. And in that Bainbridge trial, Joseph Smith Sr., said of his son, it's too bad he was doing this. He was doing it for the money because he was hired to do it, but he really needs to take his talent and dedicate it to the Lord. So I think there was a learning process going on, and it took Joseph a few years to do it. So I don't really see him vacillating back and forth as much as, all of us take a while to actually learn something. I don't know of any time after he received the plates where he ever went back to finding, lost things.
Okay. Okay. Let's jump back just for a second, and we're going to treat this really quickly, but it's such a common criticism of Joseph and of the early, beginnings of Mormonism that I just wanted to get your take. There's this, as I understand it, there few, if anyone, that Joseph ever told about the first vision sort of in the years leading up to the founding of the church. And then the telling of the first vision story as it is told today is sort of conspicuously, for some, absent for many of the, early years of the founding of the church. And then when people sort of compound that with the multiple versions of the first vision story, and how when he first writes it down or dictates it, only the Lord appears to him, not God and Jesus. In some accounts there was a satanic force, and others there weren't. And in some accounts there were angels swirling around. And there are a lot of people who just sort of say, that's just all, why didn't he tell people from the start? Why did the story change over time? Why did the story not get fully developed until 1838? When there was a crisis, and you could argue for a need for that story to get sort of embellished upon. What's your take, just your brief take on the first vision and that sort of telling of the first vision story and the critics' take on it?
Yeah, that's actually one of the things that I tried to treat in the book, although not mentioning that one in particular, but this whole idea of how do stories develop? How do we tell what we tell, and why do we decide to tell them? And a lot of the answer to that has nothing to do with, what's true and what's not true, but in how we tell our own stories. It's a question of, folklore research. How do stories change over time? And in the case of Joseph Smith, his original story was probably very similar to pretty much anybody else who'd had one of these great conversion stories. He wasn't the only one claiming to have seen God in a vision when he was a young man. And Bushman treats this, indicating it's much more likely that the reason he wasn't believed was because it was common, not because it was uncommon. the early church didn't think much of the first vision because what was really spectacular was the Book of Mormon, and they had that, and there really wasn't anything they were terribly interested in the first vision. So when you get into why are there so many different stories of the first vision, it's because it didn't interest them until later. And then, you know, why are there different versions? All you have to do is look at pretty much any history and any development of folk history, and you see that it's very common to have those different things because different audiences will want something different. So hardly surprising at all. It's just, again, part of normal history.
But some are going to go, now, wait a minute. You know, if you're talking about, like, what you had for breakfast last, you know, last Thursday, that's one thing. But when you're talking about a visit from God Almighty and His Son and, you know, something that's unforgettable and would clearly leave major impressions, then you wouldn't, you know, leave out one of those two major members of the Godhead in your recounting.
Yep. You know, as I said, that's that great perspective. If I were God, I would have done it this way. If I were Joseph, this is how I would have written my history. It's the modern perspective, taking what we expect ought to have happened and then saying, because what I expect to have happened didn't happen, then something's wrong. It's the wrong question to ask of any history. In any history, you have to ask what's happening in the history, not why didn't something happen differently because I wish it would have, or I expect it to have been differently, done differently.
Okay, I understand that, and I think that's reasonable. But would you also concede that if we were talking about the history of Jim Jones and Guyana and Jonestown, and we were evaluating the claims of Jim Jones as a religious leader, and we were to find out, or even L. Ron Hubbard in Scientology, we were to find out that, you know, stories that he told in World War II, you know, turned out to be not true, and does that strike to the heart of the credibility? My guess is you wouldn't have as charitable of a take on those changes in history or those variances in recollection as you would on Joseph. Is that fair to say?
No, not really. There's just way too much information about how we remember and why we remember. One of the things they've found out about the process of memory is that, you know, your memory of the past is conditioned by the experiences of the present. So there are a lot of things that, you know, for instance, my daughter is infamous for this. She remembers any number of things that we will have to inform her. Nope, didn't happen that way at all. She lived through them and is absolutely positive. She remembers things in certain ways, and it's a memory that's formed from something else. And the problem is, this fragile thing that we call our memory is just developed in so many different ways that to presume that memory is going to be absolutely true and never changing is just completely against the human condition and against all science of memory.
Right. And, you know, as I'm talking to you, I'm recalling an argument I had with my wife yesterday where we remembered exactly opposite.
Oh, yeah.
but it is okay. But I'm going to push this point one last time. And that's just that with something so important, you know, there is such thing as fraud. There is such thing as deception. There is such thing as, you know, mental illness, where people do make things up and people do lie and people do deceive. And we have to, you know, we have to, in some sense, be discerning and be willing to call fraud, you know, if things don't add up, right? We can't just say everyone's speaking the truth all the time, you know. So when do you draw the line and how do you draw the line?
Well, you draw the line by not accepting, you know, any single thing. And what the early church did is it said, you know, the place where we draw the line is the Book of Mormon. I can't explain it any other way. And here's this tangible thing. So the Book of Mormon would be the cane that they would lean on if they had a question about something else. They go back and say, yeah, well, there's at least the Book of Mormon. I can't do anything about that. So everything else has to be true. And when you talk about the Book of Mormon, some of those things are the same kind of thing, where you have to say, well, okay, this is questionable, but what else is there? So it's always a process. You don't accept, and you know, the word we would use these days is swallow. You know, you don't swallow everything. You work hard to understand it, and you work hard to understand what all of the ramifications are. And you don't accept one single thing. You build a case. And I think that's where Joseph Smith and his experience is. You build the case with Joseph Smith. That's where it gets stronger rather than, you know, looking at some of these individual pieces.
And that's, I'll throw you a softball here, but I can hear Fair Farm saying, you know, you can pick apart and find holes in the narrative. How do you explain the fact that thousands and eventually tens of thousands of people were willing to die for this man? Certainly over let's just say a 20 to 24 year period, he established a record of doing a lot of things that led a lot of people to believe and follow him. And you can't, if you're going to be fair, you can't just dismiss all that and only fish for the holes and inaccuracies. Is there anything you'd add to that?
Probably just that, in order to be fair, it's also true that lots of people have followings. And so, you know, even the fact that there's a following doesn't prove anything. And that's why, you know, eventually what any good missionary would tell someone is you just have to understand for yourself. It has to be something that you feel and that you understand that's a reflection of, you know, your communication with God. You know, there isn't any way to absolutely prove. And if you're looking for proof, it's almost guaranteed that you won't find it.
Right.
So, yeah, it is something that we require of faith. And I don't see that as a bad thing. Certainly not a comfortable thing. I would really like to have my world defined a little bit more black and white than that. But we're not given that kind of a world.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive. Do this and joy, your hearts will swell. journey's through.